Listening to the Mental Health Download from the nonprofit Mental Health Association Oklahoma. I'm Addie McCasland. This week's episode is sponsored by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oklahoma, who invests in and partners with nonprofit organizations that offer sustainable, measurable programs that strive to elevate the health and well-being of all Oklahomans. Today, I'm talking with Carly Dunn, a fourth-year PhD student in the Human Development and Family Science Department at Oklahoma State University, and a graduate research associate at the Center for Family Resilience. Carly helps coordinate the Oklahoma Near Science Training Community and works on school-based prevention projects to provide quality technical and research assistance to districts working to enhance mental and behavioral health efforts for students, families, and staff. Additionally, Carly is one of our 2023 Zero Mental Health Symposium presenters. I am thrilled to have Carly Dunn on today, and I hope you enjoy the dialogue surrounding Near Science and ACEs. The Mental Health Download starts now.
So my name is Carly Dunn. I am a fourth year PhD student, almost candidate, at Oklahoma State University in the Human Development and Family Science Department. And so within that, I work at the Center for Family Resilience. So it's a research center. We do a lot of translational research work that includes working with, you know, individuals, children, parents, caregivers, families, communities. We do a lot of school-based prevention. We do a whole host of things at the Center for Family Resilience. That's where the majority of my work is housed within that specific research center. Within that, I do a few different things. I work on a few key projects. We work with the State Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services in regards to MTSS, so multi-tiered systems of support. So it's helping districts across the state to really think about their mental and behavioral health programming from the bottom up. So we're helping them with those supports. And we work with several districts, wonderful folks from across the state who are trying to improve systems for students and for educators and for families and for communities. So it's really rewarding work, and I really enjoy working with folks in that space. And then I also work on some research projects in addition to really helping to coordinate the Near Science training community here in Oklahoma. So I'm one of the original Near mentor trainers. And last year, the center partnered with the Potts Family Foundation, who holds the contract for the state for the Near Science Beyond ACEs training, the curriculum specifically with ACE interface. And so what the CFR does contractually is we support the community. We automated some systems in terms of connecting with folks. We do a lot of kind of the background operational sort of things, you know, standardizing documents, making sure everybody has access to our curriculum, those sorts of things, but also thinking through outreach and support and evaluation. So there's a lot of different things, but we do that in collaboration with a few different folks. And I think that's really kind of key to note that it's not just the CFR that's helping provide the support. We really take that community-based approach where we are better together. So that's a little bit about me.
Yeah. So before we dive too deeply into the conversation, for the listeners who don't know, can you tell us what Near Science is and then what ACE is?
Yeah. Exactly. So Near Science is a collection, or I should say a constellation, of four key areas of risk and resilience research. And so what it really is, the underlying framework, is really for understanding how adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, and maybe other types of stressors and, you know, toxic health really affects health and well-being across the lifespan. It brings together, like I said, those four key areas. And usually one of the questions that I know a lot of people get in our training community is like, what is NEAR? What does it stand for? Sure. And it's those four key constellation areas. It brings together information about developmental neuroscience. So that's our end. So we talk about how our experiences kind of build brain architecture and development, which then again influences our lives across our lifespan, essentially. So we talk about neuroscience, and then we dive into epigenetics, which is a mouthful, but also just really kind of daunting for a lot of people. They're like, what is that? We really talk about how our experiences, but also our ancestors' experiences, really influence biological mechanisms and systems for individuals. Like I said, it's not only across the lifespan, but it's also across generations as well. It doesn't necessarily change like DNA sequencing, like what some people think. It's actually these little you can think of it as like light switches that are attached to our DNA sequencing. So it influences maybe incidence of maybe certain characteristic traits, or if maybe we're thinking about incidence of disease and those sorts of things. There's a lot to epigenetics, and there's a lot we still don't know about epigenetics, but we provide that introduction into thinking about really how experiences of people who came before us really are influencing us as individuals today. We also talk about the original adverse childhood experiences study, the ACEs study. So that's where our A comes in. We really start to dive into the original research. We talk about the methods of that specific research study. And then we talk about, you know, what does that mean? What did they find with that original research study specifically? And then because we don't want to end on a bummer, we want to think about those positive influences. We end with really talking about resilience. So what are these core protective systems that we can help establish for individuals and families and communities to really think through the resilience and recovery process? So that's our near science, as we cover those four key areas to really provide this holistic experience of thinking about how adversity and trauma influences across the life course.
I'm going to go back to a couple of questions on the near science part of this, but can we talk a little bit about what ACEs stands for and a little bit about that initial study?
Yeah, ACEs are adverse childhood experiences. In the original study, they looked at 10 specific indicators of factors that were preventable, but also things that may be beyond an individual's control. So they looked at those 10 experiences from birth to, you know, before an individual's 18th birthday. So something that happened in childhood. The original study, again, it was done with Kaiser Permanente and in collaboration with the CDC. Doctors Anda and Folletti were the co-principal investigators of that specific original study, and a whole host of other amazing folks who worked on that research project. But there are two people that a lot of people, you know, think about when they think of the ACEs study. And we were actually trained by Dr. Anda. The near science curriculum was developed by the person who we credit a lot of this work to. Like I said, they looked at those 10 original indicators. They looked at some indicators of household dysfunction. So you can think of those as things that happened around an individual. And then they looked at other types. They looked at, you know, abuse, neglect, things that didn't happen for people and should have, and then things that happened to an individual. So again, maybe that abuse, sexual, physical, and then looking at emotional neglect. And like I said, those key 10 indicators as well. So that's a little bit about what the actual indicators were. Like I said, there were 10 original. They interviewed people ages 19 to 94. So they had a pretty good spread, about 17,000 participants. But it's important to note that with that specific study population is that they were generally well-educated. The majority of them were white middle-class folks, and they had access to some of the best healthcare in the nation. So obviously we know if we're looking at that study population and how we look at that today is that it could be exacerbated when we're talking about prevalence or incidence of adverse childhood experiences. Within that research study, they looked at how, again, they include the original, you know, ACE survey that a lot of people probably know about. And then they asked about incidence of diseases. They looked at substance use, mental health, medication management, healthcare utilization, a whole wide of like health and social issues. And so what they found was that a dose response relationship between adverse childhood experiences and health and social problems, meaning as an individual reports an increased amount of those original 10 indicators, there was also higher incidence of disease, disability, health productivity issues within communities. It looked at populations as a whole, not necessarily risk at the individual level. So they were looking at from that population type of lens.
Sure. You mentioned that the study included, you know, generally well-educated, white, middle class. Do you know of, or do you suspect that there will be different studies that are more inclusive?
And there has been since the original study. This was done, you know, early in the 90s. There's a lot that we've learned since the original study, but it really helped to open the door. And I think what's really important too is to note that, you know, Dr. Anna Fletty, thinking about their medical background specifically. So it was kind of like a really great bridge between public health issues and then what we're seeing in our healthcare system specifically, which is great. And so I think we have a lot more you know, foundational research on how any type of traumatic stress or toxic stress, chronic stress are really influencing health outcomes specifically. I think it's a really great introduction point that kind of marries our preventative medicine or prevention work with kind of that more healthcare approach as well, which I think is really important.
Sure, sure, sure. I'm going to put you on the spot just a little bit. Do you happen to know the 10 questions that are on the ACE questionnaire, the ACE survey?
Yeah, I do. We in our near science, we talk about those four key areas of risk and resilience. But as part of that, we cover, I'm just going to pull it up so I don't like stumble over my words. The 10 indicators that were studied. So the household dysfunction they looked at, growing up in a household where somebody is experiencing a substance use disorder, parental separation or divorce, somebody in the household, again, growing up from that birth to year 18, somebody with a mental health disorder. The original study looked at specifically mothers, battered mothers. So mothers who have experienced intimate partner violence. We know that now has expanded exponentially to know that anybody could experience intimate partner violence. Also living with somebody who's experienced incarceration or part of the carceral system. So those are household dysfunctions, things that happened around an individual. And then we also have neglect. So they looked at emotional and physical neglect. So these are things that did not happen for somebody, but should have.
Right.
And then the original study looked at three forms of abuse, emotional, physical, and sexual. So those are things that happen to an individual, but should not have. One thing that's not usually talked about or asked about the original ACE study specifically, but I feel really passionate about talking about, is that a lot of people see the original, like you can pull it up online and it's like, take the ACE quiz, find your ACE score, like all of these things. The ACE score specifically, it's a really great communication tool for people to talk about their lived experiences without maybe going into detail. So, you know, just saying I have an ACE score of 6, but not having to go into detail of what those experiences were can be really helpful, kind of that really powerful connection tool. But it's also important that we form this common language when we're talking about prevention framework specifically. But more importantly, it can be really a gateway to empathy, compassion, and healing for a lot of folks at the individual and community level. But there are a lot of limitations to the ACE score that, like I said earlier, is not really talked about. It just talks about if you've experienced any of those 10 indicators from birth to before your 18th birthday or before an individual's 18th birthday. It doesn't take into account how often did that happen? Was it chronic, the frequency, the intensity? It doesn't even take into consideration gender differences. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take into consideration that individual variability of the stress response for individuals. So it's not a diagnostic tool or an appropriate screening tool or a predictor of risk really at the individual level. What it is again, it's a population level survey that was used in an epidemiological study and shouldn't really be used in clinical types of settings as well. There are a whole host of other screeners and assessments that can be used in clinical setting, but we just sometimes see the misuse of that, of it being in our medical facilities or our behavioral health facilities as well.
That makes a lot of sense. It sounds to me like it's a great dialogue tool. To get a little personal here, I went through a program that is based off of the Meadows out of Arizona, which deals a lot with ACEs because I grew up in a pretty volatile household, and I've got a younger sister who obviously did as well. And we turned out two wildly different adults. I certainly had my own fair share of struggles. Emotional struggles, kind of that walled off fear of vulnerability, wouldn't connect with other people more than a surface level. And she took a different path. Like she's had a harder time with it, has dealt with drug addiction, has dealt with some mental illness and some challenging and detrimental behavior that she has dealt with. And I guess maybe where I'm going with this is whenever I first took that ACEs quiz 2 years ago, my first thought was, how did I turn out the way I turned out and she turned out the way she turned out? Or how did I have a different set of struggles than what she had? And it makes much more sense to look at this from a different lens, that it is a dialogue tool, not a diagnostic tool.
So. Yeah, absolutely. And one key thing too is that it doesn't take into consideration a whole host of, you know, other things that are happening in our environment. So what were those protective factors? So did you have a caring, loving, supporting adult who nurtured you? Like those sorts of things, like that are what we now call PACEs. So those positive experiences that help mitigate that risk of developing maybe health issues that happen later in life based off of that experiences from birth to, you know, before age 18 and even beyond that as well. That's another thing too, is like, it doesn't take into consideration those factors that are really important to think about that help build resilience at the individual level.
Sure. That's where I was going to go next, actually. Yeah. I worked my way through the near, but from the bottom up, I suppose.
Yeah.
As I was prepping for this interview, I was talking to the director of my department. And I was asking her if she had any questions that she was interested in hearing answers from you about. And she said, I'd like for you to ask about resilience. You know, two people who grew up in the same household or similar set of circumstances, one becoming more resilient than the other. How does that happen?
So resilience is really interesting. The field of resilience research. And there's a couple different ways. And I think some criticism of the field of resilience being, that's a dramatic area within my department, specifically in HDFS, is that like, how are we defining resilience? Are we looking at this as like an individual trait, which I think a lot of, you know, people from the psychology realm may look at it as a personality trait versus some people look at resilience as a process, which is what we do specifically within human development, family science, or at least a lot of my work specifically looks at it as a process, meaning that not just labeling an individual as resilient, because that puts a lot of pressure on an individual, but also thinking like, Why aren't I resilient? Why am I having these positive experiences and those sorts of things? So I think that's really kind of important to talk about. But in terms of resilience and research specifically, noting that, yes, there can be two individuals, the environment maybe look very similar. But like I said, age, gender differences, there are a lot of factors that influence the timing of those experiences. Did that happen when somebody was, maybe you were 9 months old and your sister was, let's say, 3 years old. So maybe there's like their age difference that may be kind of playing a factor as well. And just because we're in similar environments, just because we are all unique as individuals. So our experiences, what we take away from that experience, looks drastically different on that individual level specifically. I think that's kind of key and important to note as well, but also looking at, like I said, we don't have the same experiences even outside of the home as well. So maybe how we connect with other people and what that looks like could also, you know, influence the resilience process as well. I don't know if that answered your question.
I feel like it did. Yeah.
Okay.
And the epigenetics, can I ask you to just restate what epigenetics is?
Yes, yeah. For sure. So epigenetics is relatively a newer field of science when we talk about like other sorts of things. People have been studying epigenetics for a very long time, but considered kind of newer, I would say, kind of in biological systems. But it's essentially looks at how experiences kind of like get under our skin. If we think about it, you know, our genes are contained in the DNA of our cells. Genes provide instructions for specific cells to become, you know, liver cells, heart cells, kidney cells, those sorts of things. But they also contain really key agents and key predictors when we're talking about disease and well-being across the life course. So what epigenetics really tells us about is like the ways that those instructions of our genes are actually used, transcribed, and read. So what we do in neuroscience specifically is we talk about, you know, the structure of DNA, and then we talk about laying that foundation and how epigenetics involves those chemical attachments that are kind of happening. So we have a newer neuroscience trainer who I think you would love to talk to, Dr. Dolores Vasquez San Roman. She is a faculty member at OSU Health Science Center, and her research is in epigenetics and neuroscience specifically. She does a lot of studies on with rats or mice specifically, and then looking at how, again, we are not in a controlled environment as rats. So even studying animals and kind of those epigenetic markers, we can't necessarily say this is happening within human populations or even human studies, because we're not in those very well-controlled environments as well. So I think that's one kind of key note to talk about it. But yeah, there's a lot of great resources. We kind of just skim the surface on what is epigenetics, you know, how are our experiences really transmitted and carried from one generation to the next. And we talk about one key study that was a rat study that was, people maybe know it as a cherry blossom study. They put rats in a very controlled environment. They exposed them to a specific scent. Long story short, they shocked their feet. And that scent was introduced into their environment and it really conditioned them to be fearful of that specific cherry blossom scent. So they bred that population of rats, and then they studied the offspring for multiple generations. What they did for those multiple generations is they put them in a very similar environment. They exposed them to that smell of cherry blossoms, but they didn't introduce the shock. What they found is that they were having very similar responses as their ancestors in that original cohort that had that shock experience, which is really interesting. So it provided that understanding of that biological mechanism that our experiences can be inherited and passed from one generation to the next. So again, if they are having the same biological responses as that original cohort, but there wasn't that introduction of the shock, I mean, that was really groundbreaking. That was huge. And so they looked, like I said, multiple generations after that, and they could actually trace those responses back seven generations.
So that correlates really well through, say, the topic of intergenerational trauma, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yes. That, you know, yes. Epigenetics, intergenerational trauma, I think is another kind of just reframing of talking about, yeah, how our experiences are passed from one generation to the next.
That is fascinating. So it sounds like, you know, outside experiences can influence the way your physiological responses, right?
Yeah.
And can absolutely be passed along from generation to generation. You said up to seven generations is what we know. A two-part question. Number one, does that response decrease from generation to generation as long as they're not exposed to the trauma? And two, can epigenetics be influenced positively or impacted positively?
Yeah, I am not an epigeneticist, so I have a very baseline knowledge of neuroscience. But we always talk about epigenetics in terms of those risk factors specifically, but we don't necessarily talk about how positive experiences influence from generation to generation. So can a positive, loving relationship with a primary caregiver mitigate earlier risk from past generations? And I think that is a growing field of inquiry within science specifically. So I don't know the answer to your question. Like I said, Dr. Sam Roman would be so happy to talk with you about that. That's a lot of her research. And like I said, she is even shifting, I think, her research should really talk more about the resilient side of epigenetics. So kind of more that hopeful of, you know, how are those positive experiences from a caregiver or within the community really influences on that biological level specifically. So sorry, I don't have any more information.
No worries. No worries. It's a neurobiology part of NEAR. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So we really build a foundation. Like I said, what NEAR science does is we build that baseline foundation for information, education, and awareness. And so that all starts with talking about how our experiences are literally hardwired into our biology. So we talk about the central nervous system, you know, how it connects us to ourselves, obviously, but to the people around us and to the world, you know, we're living in specifically. So we talk about how brain architecture is really influenced by our experiences, because if we think about how the brain develops from most primitive to most advanced, it's really important to talk about synaptic density. So we talk about how our wiring of our brain occurs, and that is the result of our lived experiences. So at the time of birth, we talk about synaptic density in neuroscience. We talk about what the brain, what our neurons look like at the time of birth, about elementary age, and then we talk about like what's happening during puberty. Like I said, the wiring of our brain really is this making of these really complex neural networks, and it is experience dependent. So what we think about that is what gets experienced most tends to lead to those more robust connections between nerve cells that form those specific networks. And that is called branching or arborization. At the time of birth, there isn't a lot of connections that are happening because, again, our brains are built based off of our experiences. As we grow and as we age, even thinking about that birth to elementary age specifically, is that what's happening at that specific point in life is that we're only born with the set of skills that we need at that specific time. When we're babies, we think eating, breathing, you know, regulating ourselves, but also connecting with a primary caregiver, those sorts of things. So if those aren't experienced early in life, obviously that impacts the foundation for brain development for your brain in the future specifically. We talk about, you know, branching, arborization, but also the pruning process. When we talk about pruning specifically, there are fewer connections between brain cells, specifically when we're talking about early elementary age and puberty. And that's because the least experienced connections actually tend to withdraw about the same age as puberty. And that's that process that I referenced earlier that's called pruning. It really helps to explain why, you know, neglect or not getting those experiences that we need have really profound impacts on health and social functioning overall. So with neuroscience, again, we're just laying a foundation for talking about how our experiences influence our brain and brain development across the life course, but specifically maybe talking about what's happening in those kind of earlier years from birth to about age 18. But again, we still don't know everything about developmental brain science as well. We know that there are certain capacities that we develop well into our 30s, which is a really helpful side of things as well. Again, it's not all talking about how negative experiences are influencing us or hardwiring us for living in a maybe a dangerous world based off of our lived experiences. It's because we are adaptive. And I think that's a really key take home. We're talking about brain science is that, yes, some individuals may experience this, and these are some of the consequences developmentally of their experiences. But that's not to say that they don't have anything to contribute to our society or it's maladaptive. Our brains are adaptive. We are adapting to the experiences that happened earlier in life as well. So somebody who grew up in a really maybe loving household would be free from chaotic stress and those sorts of things and toxic stress. Their brains are more adaptive to maybe more tranquil times in community versus somebody who grew up in a very chaotic household, maybe witnessed intimate partner violence and, you know, those sorts of things, maybe some of those original 10 indicators. Their brains are adapting to that world that they grew up in. And talking about those characteristics they may develop based off of their experiences, they can be really great helping professionals. So people who work well under pressure, they are adapting to their lived experiences. And I think that that's also not talked about. We really do this blame and shame for a lot of people is that we're blaming people for having normal adaptive responses to their childhood specifically. So that looks like maybe having a more, you know, punitive approach to that as well. So if somebody has a substance use disorder or mental health disorder, we know that increases their likelihood of experiencing incarceration. So it's that punitive approach. But really, I think when we start to understand how our experiences influence our brain and our brain development, hopefully that can be a foundation for compassion, empathy, for us to reframe that of, you know, maybe what we're seeing is, you know, adversity is at the heart of what we're seeing. It's not just a personal choice or people just need to pull themselves up from their bootstraps when that's really counterproductive to what we're talking about within the curriculum specifically.
So as I was reading a little bit about this yesterday, and one point that I came across that said, I'll just read it verbatim. It said, a study was designed to answer the following question. If risk factors for disease, disability, and early mortality are not randomly distributed, what early life influences precede the adoption or development of them? Do you have an answer to that?
So the ACE study specifically, the hypothesis of the ACE study, you know, is biologically sound, meaning that it's a life course model specifically. Think of it as a pyramid specifically. At the base of the pyramid, we have adverse childhood experiences, which we know influences social, emotional, and cognitive functioning, which therefore increases our risk of specific health behaviors or disease risk, those sorts of things, which leads to disability, you know, social problems, dysfunctions, and then that leads to early death. And that's across the life course specifically. But what's really important is that there's also historical and intergenerational trauma that's at the base of that pyramid specifically. So when we think about the progressive nature of adversity specifically, when we know people have that early and traumatic stress, there's a predictable pattern of, you know, brain architecture, development, traits, behaviors, characteristics, you know, those sorts of things. There's a really great graphic that's talking about the root that's a tree. And so we think about, like, what are the roots of that tree? What is the foundation in which that tree is being built? So how is trauma or adverse childhood experiences, like, what is at the root cause of what's going on specifically? So we think about people not having access to resources, thinking about unemployment, discrimination, lack of housing and opportunities, those sorts of things that really kind of already set communities back, individuals back from living, again, in those sorts of communities that don't have access to those resources. And obviously that could be a root cause of maybe why parents or caregivers are stressed, and those sorts of things of why we see that intergenerational approach, but also thinking about they may have these lived experiences and then they're living in environments that are just really conducive to being maybe relationship oriented or to having those opportunities to really connect with other individuals as well. It's very stressful. So obviously we have higher levels of stress within the environment. Obviously there could be an increased risk of, you know, experiencing adversity as well. So in terms of, like I said, populations, the original ACE study looked at, again, white middle-class folks, the majority of them were in that space, had access to some of the best healthcare. Well, obviously we know if they have access to healthcare, they probably also had specific set of resources and skills, generally well-educated. So when we take that away and people do not have those opportunities, obviously there's going to be an increased risk based off of kind of those root causes specifically. And then we do know, again, we think about lack of opportunity and resources and historical trauma, obviously, you know, our BIPOC community and looking at how maybe those concentrations, and for some people that really does lead to like blaming and shaming of like, well, why are there higher concentration of ACEs in this community? Well, it's because, again, that historical trauma, There's no access to resources or even culturally competent resources. That's the key part of all of this as well, is that even if we folks are providing resources to communities, are they culturally competent? Are they aware? Are they trauma-informed? Which I won't get on a tangent, but trauma-informed is it's a buzzword today. How I operate specifically is, you know, trauma-informed is a continuum. So before we say we're trauma-informed, we have to be aware that trauma is a developmental consequence of trauma in the first place. The Missouri model is a great framework for that. So we think about, in order to be trauma-informed, we have to be aware, we have to be sensitive, we have to have policies and procedures that are in place In order to be trauma-informed as well. So I think that's another key part of this whole conversation of trauma-informed approaches and foundations and supports for folks.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mentioned the outside stressors that somebody might experience, especially if they are experiencing a lack of resources. Mm-hmm. At Mental Health Association of Oklahoma, most of our work actually exists where homelessness and mental illness meet.
Yeah.
And just last week, I was sitting in an interview with our Oklahoma City clinical director. She was interviewing with a journalist, and he was asking about that intersection. And one of the comments she made was, well, somebody who lives in an uninhabitable place, you know, they live in an encampment or under a bridge or in the woods, you know, they're constantly in like that flight or fight mode, survival mode, which creates maybe not low grade, but a constant level of stress or constant stressor, whether it's peaks or valleys. Can you talk a little bit about what that sort of experience, how those constant stressors might affect somebody, and maybe help us gain a little bit more understanding of why living in constant survival mode can affect your mental health so tremendously?
Yeah. So what we know is that humans are only made to be under stress for about 20 minutes at a time. If you think about our day-to-day lives, sometimes that's laughable for people. They're like, oh, only 20 minutes. But that is really, thinking of it like biologically, that really is long enough for us to prepare for that fight, flight, freeze response that we have, you know, biologically. So experiences that cause like these stress chemicals to be continuously produced, for example, child abuse, neglect, being in a war zone, which kind of think about that continuous stress, really have an impact on development, specifically when we talk about those experiences on the developing brain. Like I said earlier, you know, think about brain development, people who live in maybe those types of chaotic environments and relationships. And under those circumstances, our bodies really tend to prepare for a life in a more dangerous world, so to say. And we know that stress hormones really exert, you know, influence on our cells, our wiring, our chemistry. And so they really sculpt brains that are wired for certain characteristics. Being edgy, being hot-tempered, hypervigilant, withdrawn, dissociative, numb, there's a whole risk, or I should say risk, there's a whole set of characteristics for why that might be specifically that individual's response. So people who had traumatic stress from conception to toddler years, they really likely have a higher baseline of stress hormones, specifically like cortisol, as the result in their bodies. So when we think about when like those stress hormones like cortisol hanging out in our bodies for too long, it becomes damaging to brain cells. That's why we call that continuous, unpredictable stress, toxic stress. It's true because it literally can kill or, you know, our brain cells. So if we think, yeah, and it's fascinating, but also when we think about this happening specifically in childhood as well, is that we're missing that opportunity to build really robust, healthy neural networks. We're experiencing very chaotic relationships, environments, and what that looks like specifically. So in neuroscience, we talk about that. We talk about how that continuous stress, again, influences our stress hormones and how that influences our biological mechanisms and systems as well, which is really important. So obviously, if somebody experienced that in maybe early childhood, we can trace that back to specific behaviors or trace it to specific behaviors that they're having later on in life. And that's not to say this happens just in childhood. We know there are stressful and traumatic events that happen after somebody is 18 as well. But if somebody is experiencing that in adulthood, obviously that's also influencing those biological mechanisms and systems as well. So mm-hmm. we have too much stress in our lives and we're continuously producing that cortisol and having high levels of cortisol that are sustained over a period of time. Obviously, we're more likely to have negative consequences. So that could look like mental health, substance use. There's a lot of different ways in which kind of stress hormones influence our health and well-being across the life course. But obviously, yes, somebody experiencing homelessness, somebody experiencing incarceration, those are really stressful environments, regardless of age. And so I think it's important to note also that it's not just focusing on early childhood, but also thinking about folks, you know, when they're 18, it's a lot of people, you know, they love helping children, which we love. We want more people to be helping our children. But also noting that we also need to help those folks who experienced, you know, developmental trauma mm-hmm. after they're 18. It's not just once they're 18, they're on their own. They're going into the world and they're productive members of society and those sorts of things. It's like, we need to be actively thinking about what supports do they need to really live their best life and thinking about healing and growing and thriving within their community or where they want to be specifically. And so that happens, yeah, after 18. It's not just this cutoff point. Really to be, I think, as a community, as a research community, but also just as a community in general, like this collective consciousness of not just having these punitive approaches of, well, you're 18, you know better, you're on your own. We all need love and support and nurturing environments. And that goes for adults as well. When we don't have those opportunities in early childhood, maybe we also don't have those opportunities in adulthood either. So we don't maybe learn how to regulate ourselves. And obviously, when we don't learn how to regulate ourselves, that could have a whole host of consequences as well. So I think it's not just about childhood. It's just about kind of the human condition as a whole. It's like we have an opportunity to help folks build those skills and provide those accommodations that are a result of their biology, what happened to them. It's, again, changing that narrative, that trauma-informed approach of what happened to you. It's not just, you know, what did you do? Those sorts of things as well. It's like, what happened?
Sure. So it sounds like, I'm not a scientist, but from this conversation with you and just from the surface level things that I've read in newspapers and, you know, that's, it sounds like everything points to hope, right? In that studies have been showing that you can reroute your neural pathways, which is pretty incredible and pretty hopeful. So if you have lived under this constant level of stress and you started to, you know, your brain is going down one path, if you can remove yourself, or you can be removed with support from your community or your family or loved ones from that stressful situation, if you can get off the streets and move into a house and engage the support that's available to you, then you can reroute your neural pathways. You can start to heal and begin to live a fulfilling, self-sustaining, thriving life. There is hope for these individuals.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, hope is part of the resilience process. And what I'm really excited about as a junior research and somebody who's quickly about to graduate and kind of, you know, enter this space is that we have some leading experts in those protective experiences here in Oklahoma that people don't always know about. CIRCA, so the Center for Integrative Research on Childhood Adversity, Dr. Amanda Morris and Jennifer Hayes Grudo are leaders on what they developed, the PACES. So again, like I said earlier, that anecdote to ACEs is thinking about those protective and compensatory experiences. Are those positive experiences that can help increase resilience, but also protect against risk for mental health, physical illness, those sorts of things. Kind of think of it as this heart model. They have a really great resource on our extension page at OSU that kind of talks about this, but it's talking about, you know, supportive relationships and resources that really make up that kind of heart-shaped model. So we know that adults who have many PACEs or those positive experiences in early childhood or in childhood really have fewer problems related to health and well-being, even if they do have a history of ACEs. So it's, again, looking at how they really mitigate or moderate our level of risk based on our previous experience as well. So yeah, resilience is incredible. You know, the 10 PACEs, again, those indicators that they look at is that anecdote is looking at, you know, having a parent or caregiver that is, you know, that provides unconditional love, spending time with friends and kind of having those positive peer relationships, volunteering or helping others, being active in a social group, having a mentor outside of the family, you know, living in the clean, safe home with enough food, having opportunities to learn, having a hobby, being active with, you know, pro-social involvement, or having, you know, routines and kind of fair rules at the home as well. So all those things that, like I said, may help mitigate and adverse health experiences and developmental consequences of that later on as well. So there are powerful opportunities and pathways to really build resilient communities. And that starts with that foundation of knowledge and understanding. We have to understand how trauma influences us across the lifespan, how it influences our communities. If we don't know the why, we don't really know the what and the how. So right. That's what I really love about neuroscience is that we provide this holistic picture of how our experiences influence us across the life course. And that really sets the stage for coming in with additional programming and supports, because like I said, kind of thinking as a pyramid model, near being at the base of providing that why. So why do we need to be trauma informed? Why do we need to have these specific approaches? And why do we help people build these specific skills? Well, it's because we know that our experiences influence our brain development, which then influences our development, our ability to connect with somebody, our relationships, and that's well into adulthood. It's not just during those early developmental stages. And so there is a hopeful side of all of this as well as thinking. And I think that's where some research is starting to go. We're moving away specifically from that deficit model or that risk model to think about, okay, this is a very bleak situation, but are there opportunities and pathways for hope and resilience to really intervene to help that recovery and risk, resilience and recovery, that process? Like, how do we help support that?
I always like to end on a hopeful note. Is there anything else about neurosciences or ACEs that you would like for the listeners to know that we haven't covered?
Yeah. So I think just a little bit about the neuroscience program, the availability here in Oklahoma specifically. So again, thinking about how this came to Oklahoma, and it's a really powerful professional development opportunity for anybody here in our state, is that the Potts Family Foundation, which is a small family foundation in Oklahoma City, they started showing the resilience film. A lot of their work previously has been around in the early childhood space. So how do we protect, nurture, and love children in early childhood? So they did a lot of that work. They started showing the resilience film, Biology of Stress. showing that across the state, just to kind of heighten the awareness of adverse childhood experiences and, again, the developmental and lifelong consequences of toxic stress and trauma. And what they found is they had panels after they would do those screenings, and people were saying, this is great. This is great information, but like, what's next? Like, what additional things can we tap into? And so they wrote for a grant through Blue Cross and Blue Shield. So that's Healthy Kids, Healthy Families program specifically. And so they brought Dr. Anda and Laura Porter, again, Dr. Anda being the co-principal investigator of the original ACEs study. They collectively have ACE Interface. So they created ACE Interface, which is the near science curriculum. They train cohorts of individuals within states to disseminate this information. Maybe it's be surprising to some folks, maybe not so much, is that not everybody knows about adverse childhood experiences. It's very normalized in some settings. It's like, well, that's just the way life was growing up. That's just how it is. And that's not normal. It kind of thinking about kind of, you know, overall development specifically. And so with that grant, they trained 30 folks from across our state. We all represent different sectors, different communities. We're embedded in different settings across the entire state. So we had 30 folks, and that happened in March of 2021. We were trained via Zoom during the height of COVID. And so what we did, it was an experience. So 30 of us were trained in that original cohort, myself included. And so we started doing these professional learning opportunities, which is near. Again, we needed that. We need to set that foundation for thinking through how are we trauma informed. And first, we have to be aware and educated. So that's where we start with NEAR specifically. Through the years since we've started, we have several folks that were embedded in our State Department of Health, and they are great champions. They actually developed a THREAD initiative, and part of that includes trauma and resilience. And so they trained, there was a group of five original folks in the original cohort that are part of our State Department of Health. And what they did was they trained presenters. So our mentor level trainers, again, are folks that are trained by Dr. Anda and by Laura Porter in NEAR Science. And we can provide anywhere from an hour to 8 hours plus worth of our curriculum, including hands-on experiences, resources, those sorts of things. So what they did was they trained a group across their different sectors within the health department, again, and they represent folks from all across the state as well to be presenters. And so what they do is provide that kind of basic 1.5 hour curriculum to anybody within their communities, which is really key and important because folks with lived experiences should be involved in the process. Absolutely. So they're doing that information. We just trained our second cohort of mentor trainers. So we had an additional 30 mentor level trainers to our NEAR Science community. So we have 60 folks across our state who are able to do that full 8+ hours worth of curriculum. And then again, the health department has really grown their THREAD initiative and their presenter level folks. So altogether, we have 121 people from across the state of Oklahoma who can provide NEAR Science to anybody in the state of Oklahoma free of charge. This is a free, yes, we've trained over 7,000 Oklahomans so far since we started. And like I said, as this is free, we estimate we've provided over $2 million worth of free professional development on this holistic view of experiences and developmental trauma across the lifespan, which I think is really kind of key and really, really cool. And I love to brag about our community because we're doing really great work. And we have really a great group of passionate people in education. We have people in behavioral health settings, Lighthouse Behavioral Health, for example. They have a few folks that are trained in their space. Our health department, JA, our Office of Juvenile Affairs, Oklahoma Department of Health and Substance Abuse Services. So we're being really strategic about what are spaces that are still we need to break into. Thinking about our business communities, our business sector, how adversity impacts business productivity. That's a key area that we can provide that baseline foundational knowledge and think through what would be best for their community and building those supports. So yeah, we have a whole host of folks. We do free screenings of the resilience film, as well as the Potsman Foundation coordinates that. And then we also do the NEAR Science as well. So I think there are a lot of free opportunities for a wide range of folks in our state that can really tap into this as a resource. So again, they can start to think about Okay, this is really heavy. This is really big. This seems very massive, but how can we start to chip away at those consequences of adversity and toxic stress? And how do they build their own roadmap for resilience and recovery, which is really important, is that we don't push, like, these are things that you need to do in order to recover from, you know, the toxic consequences of adversity. It's you are the experts in your own community. And how do we help support you in the process of building your roadmap towards recovery? So I think that's a really key part of this as well, is that we're just trying to set that foundation. We believe everybody should know about this information to really help maybe them on their own healing journey, but also with their communities and the families that live in their communities.
Thank you, Carly. I don't want to give any part of your presentation away, but I do want to mention that you are one of our presenters at our Zero Mental Health Symposium. Brain science is the theme this year. Can you tell our listeners the name of your presentation?
Yes. So my name of the presentation, so it's Near Science Beyond ACEs. We pre-recorded that. So it's myself, Dr. Lana Beasley, who is a professor at Oklahoma State University in the Human Development and Family Science Department, as well as Roxanne Bilby. Roxanne is the executive director of Volunteers for Youth. She's out of Rogers County, and all of us are part of the original mentor training group of Near Science. So we collectively came together to present Near Science Beyond ACEs, where we talk about neurobiology, epigenetics, ACEs, and resilience.
This is going to be a fascinating topic. Thank you so much. Really excited.
Thank you.
I really hope you enjoyed this conversation with Carly Dunn and that it has you excited to dive into Near Science Beyond ACEs at the 2023 Zero Mental Health Symposium themed New Horizons in Brain Science. For more information and to register, please visit www.zerosymposium.org. Thank you for listening to the Mental Health Download.